our question that we always ask for levels. What did you have for breakfast today?
Today, I had a late morning, which was nice. And so I made a sunny side up egg with green onion kimchi and shredded cheese. We had this like Trader Joe's shredded random cheese and then toast. Yeah. You know,
what is it?
It's like three cheeses, but you never know which ones they are. I'm Soleil Ho. I'm the restaurant critic at the San Francisco Chronicle.
What does that feel like saying that?
It feels weird. I haven't really had a proper job title in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, I cook food at this place or I write for so-and-so. And so this is just, it's something you would put on a business card and that's very strange.
For you. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So let's talk about, you said you were in kitchens. You worked in kitchens for a long time. And I'm wondering, you know, how that distinguishes you from another critic who hasn't worked in a kitchen? Like, what do you think about and see that someone else may not because you've been, like, in it?
I wouldn't say that it's necessary to have to, you know, make the thing or know how to make the thing to critique it, obviously, right? Because if you get a pizza delivered and, you know, you don't like it, there are still reasons that are legitimate for you not liking that pizza. But I will say that working at restaurants and in kitchens has helped me see process a lot more transparently. If something arrives at the table not hot, right? For example, soup. The soup is cold. I can sort of trace the steps of that dish from inception to delivery and think about all the ways in which the process has broken down and come up with a thesis based on that as to what happened. For me, that's what's been the most instrumental, is just having a greater understanding of how all these pieces work together to build a restaurant.
And does that make you more sympathetic or less sympathetic?
Traditionally, it has made me more sympathetic because I understand. But at the same time, I am more, I have higher standards also because of that, because I can see how easy it can be to mess up an order or just have things fall apart. And I can also see how easy it is to make sure that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about your years working inside kitchens?
Yeah.
Like, where was that? How did it happen?
It was all over. So I started shortly after I graduated from college because I graduated during the recession in 2009. And so restaurant work, farm work, that sort of stuff was easier to get than something that would actually use my bachelor's degree in the way that was traditionally meant to be used, because I majored in history.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just worked in kitchens for about 9 years from that point. And I was working in writing as well a little bit, just writing little pieces around town for very little money. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that there would ever be money in food writing because I was just a nobody. And so I did both of those things simultaneously. I worked in kitchens in Minneapolis, St. Paul, New Orleans, Portland, Oregon, and Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Mm. So just kind of everywhere. And slowly just advanced throughout the stages. So I've worked, you know, in the salad station, pastry, line, making fish, butchery, to management as well.
Do you have a favorite, like, station or...
I really liked butchering rabbits.
What? Okay. All right.
They look kind of like cats if you remove
the head. And that's what makes it memorable?
Yeah. Because, you know, not that I enjoy dismembering animals, but it was just an interesting process to do whole animal butchery, but like on a small scale.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, yeah, I know exactly how to cut this so that you get all of the best meat pieces from this creature. And, you know, like, I'm not a vegetarian. So getting close and personal with that was really refreshing and important to me.
When was, like, if we go back in time to your childhood, like, I remember a point where I found out that the meat I'm eating was actually an animal when I was little, like when I was really little. And it put me off meat for a while. And then, you know, as you grow, you kind of understand the origins of food. Do you remember a time when you were little, when you, like, first discovered that, like, meat came from an animal, and like the carrots we're eating come from the ground. And
I can tell you two stories. So I have this very distinct memory of being in elementary school at my grandma's house, and she made scrambled eggs for me. And
was this in Illinois?
In Illinois, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I realized that baby chicks also come from eggs. And I started to pick through the scrambled eggs to find the baby so to make sure I wouldn't eat it, which was very indicative of like how anxious of a person I ended up being as an adult. So there's that.
Yeah, that's similar.
And the second story is I distinctly remember being in line for the Spider-Man movie when I was in high school and reading a book that was an anthology of essays. And one of the essays was about the slaughterhouse system and industrial agriculture. And I didn't realize how gross it was, the wholesale slaughtering of meat, you know, animals. And that really woke me up to just, and then that's when I became a vegetarian for a few years.
So you were a vegetarian?
Yes. I remember, yeah, the Spider-Man movie, because I guess there was a line and I was there on opening weekend. And so I was just waiting to get into this, and I brought this giant book, which was, the title was Everything You Know Is Wrong, because I was that kind of like butthead when I was a kid, like, oh, that looks great. It was just edgy enough to like catch my attention.
Yeah.
But they had really good essays about capitalism and the industrial food system. And so that was really instrumental, actually.
For me growing up, I remember having distinct home food, which is our traditional meals that we had at home that my mom made. And then you'd go out into the world, or you'd go to school or wherever. And it's, you know, the common quote unquote American food, like the pizza and the hamburgers and pastas. And like my memories of that time were those two worlds don't mix. And when they did mix, like when I had a friend come over for dinner and I'd hear something like, ew, what's that green slime you're eating? And like what effect that has on a kid. How did you reconcile the at home and the outside, or did they mix when you were growing up?
Well, first, I'm curious what the green slime was.
The green slime is called molojía. Molojía here, when we buy it, what's written on it is Jews mellow.
Oh, is that the herb, right?
It's plant. Like a green leaf. And we make it into like a stew with meat, and we eat it. Either we kind of like dip, either we dip bread into it or we eat it with rice. And it is very green, and it is a stew that is kind of, it has this texture of being gooey a little bit. And we love it, right? And so I don't remember who it was from my friends who came over and immediately was like, you know, the green slime. But it's called molojía. And thank you for asking, Solejo.
Of course. I mean, I'm so curious. Yeah, it's mucilaginous, right? Like okra.
Yes.
Got it.
Yes.
Cool.
It ends up being that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And interestingly enough, now I'm finding it at the farmer's market.
Very cool.
Like some Asian communities use it as well. Mm-hmm. All that to ask that yeah. This isn't about me. But what about you? Did you have that kind of two worlds of food thing?
Sort of. So my parents and grandparents were from Vietnam. They were refugees, as, you know, I think a lot of people from war-torn countries tend to be, you know, when they leave. And so as part of the deal of being accepted into the United States, they didn't have a lot of stuff. They didn't have a lot of resources to bring with them. And so they also got placed. They didn't get to choose where they ended up. And so they ended up in the middle of nowhere in Illinois. No offense.
Illinois is great. Illinois is great.
But that meant that they didn't have access to the ingredients that they were able to understand, you know, like fish sauce or even rice noodles, that sort of stuff. They had to drive 3 hours to Chicago to get that. What also happened was they ended up relying on donations from church, food pantry stuff, welfare. And that meant they ate a lot of American ingredients, American foods. And so I grew up eating Wonder Bread, Coca-Cola, that sort of stuff. And my family shaped those foods into a paradigm that they understood.
Like how?
So on our trips to Chicago, for instance, they would buy like the Maggi seasoning.
Oh, yes.
The fish sauce, all of those elements, mm-hmm. and would marry those elements with the foods that were very American. For instance, you know, banh mi, the sandwich, I think that many people know now. Mm-hmm. For us, it was a slice of toasted Wonder Bread, Braunschweiger, like from the grocery store, that little Oscar Mayer like chub. Uh-huh. Of liver and a little bit of butter and Maggi.
That was the banh mi.
Yeah.
Oh. So you didn't have two worlds of food. You had one world that was mixed.
Yes. To me, I think that's an interesting story as well, you know, because we compromised a lot with food. And we... You know, when you think about fusion, for instance, mm-hmm. it is like a white gaze applied to ingredients from elsewhere.
Right.
But for me, how I grew up was it's the gaze of, I guess, the subaltern, right, or of people of color, where we are looking out into this world that is very white mm-hmm. and trying to understand it and shape it to our understanding mm-hmm. and our paradigms, our frameworks. And that, to me, feels very revolutionary. Where we are trying to shape this white supremacist world into something that we understand that we can accept rather than vice versa, which is the more typical narrative. So, you know.
Which is what your grandparents were doing.
Yes.
At that time.
And I think we don't appreciate that enough. Uh-huh. People who write about food from communities of color and mm-hmm. food from immigrant communities. I think this narrative has often been we are shaped by the environment, but I think thinking about the ways in which we shape our environment in turn is also very interesting. Mm.
Oh, for sure. And that makes me think about, you know, just like fast forward to today, right? We're in the Bay Area, lots of diverse restaurants with all kinds of foods and the communities who make it, you know, you can get your quote unquote authentic. What do you think about that also? Kind of Americanized versions of food versus authentic versions of food. What are your feelings about that?
I think when you are striving for authenticity, you're always going to lose. Hmm. Because everyone has their own idea of what's authentic. Everyone has a grandparent, right? Everyone has that reference that no one else has that seems closest to the truth. And I think this is also, I don't know, I think this fits with like my philosophy on truth as well, because we all have our different versions of what is true. And to fight over what is authentic and what is not tends to just be an assertion of like whose truth is more truthful. Mm-hmm. And to me, it is just a futile task.
And according to whom?
Like, right.
Who gets to be the judge on that?
Exactly. And nostalgia, I think, crystallizes our memories in a way that reality will never live up to. Mm. And that's why authenticity as a yardstick of quality just doesn't feel fair to anyone.
Mm. One thing that's so refreshing about you is that you have this honesty and this transparency. Your latest review was of a restaurant that I live in Union City, so all about the Union City, Fremont, you know, Hayward area, and you reviewed Jine Jine. And I was just like wondering how you decided that I'm going to just tell things like they are. I'm going to say in this article that I don't know much about Burmese food, right? And I'm going to be that person that's going to be like vulnerable and honest and just tell it like it is. As an approach, how did you decide on that?
I think it's really risky to do that, especially as a woman of color in a position like this, where I am pressured to be the expert, because otherwise I would be making everyone who thinks I'm not qualified correct, you know? Mm-hmm. Because I am very different compared to people who have come before me, just demographically. And so, you know, whenever we break into these industries that are very homogenous, there can be a lot of pressure to exceed, you know, be twice as good.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't need to tell you that.
That's a pressure.
And so for me, the most revolutionary and strange thing to do would be to admit that weakness. And it was a gamble, Because otherwise, you know, people could be like, oh, wow, what a dummy that she doesn't know like such and such food. Or, you know, why are we listening to her? Why are we reading her work if she doesn't know anything? Mm. So I had a lot of anxiety going into that. Mm. At the same time, I also got a lot of feedback from some readers who were uncomfortable with not knowing. And that's why they didn't go to restaurants that didn't fit into their own community. You know, like,
because you also talk about you've noticed people shy away from restaurants or food they can't pronounce.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a complication to that, too, because my family's names are unpronounceable to people who are not Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. You can learn how to pronounce them, just like they all learned how to say the word February when they came here.
Or Tchaikovsky.
Right. Or Tchaikovsky. Or the word chronicle. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. It is possible. And so I wanted to model that behavior and just say, like, no, like, we learned and you can learn. And learning is not shameful. So part of it is maybe like this self-helpy kind of thing that I tend to do, where I love talking about ways to be mm-hmm. a good person and a better person. Not that I know, I'm not an expert in that, but like, I am always trying and I want to share that with people, with readers, because, you know, I think if we're going to try to be better for each other as a community, then we should be vulnerable too.
What's wrong with the term ethnic food? Because I don't like it either. And I love that you don't like it, that term. It just, it's not accurate. Like, ethnic, according to who? Mm-hmm.
It's a practical thing. We all have an ethnicity. We all have height. We all have eye colors. We all have bodies. And so it's, to me, ethnic food is just, it's strange. Because doesn't all food have an ethnic background? But if we're using that term to refer to only some kinds of restaurants, then that's just white supremacy.
And we're othering.
Yes. Mm. It's like saying, you know, person of height or person of
weight.
Right. And we all have it. Let's just say what it is. Mm-hmm. It's okay. They're not like people or foods or cultures that are of an ethnicity that's all of it. It's all of us. And so to use the term in that way just, I think, calcifies racial categories. It puts forth this argument that only some people have an ethnicity of note mm-hmm. as well. They're not default. Mm-hmm. And to use that term feels really benign, but at the same time, you are just affirming that they are different.
Do you think you're revolutionizing restaurant critiquing?
I don't know if true revolution is possible under that framework in the end. I don't know. It's not like anything's being burnt down. In the end, I am providing a service. I work within these limitations that I don't know.
You don't know?
Yeah.
You don't think you are? Decolonizing?
I think decolonizing is complicated, right? Because in the end, I am also a settler. Hmm. I don't know if it's possible for me to do it.
Do you carry any condiments with you in your purse?
Oh, my gosh. No, because all I have is chapstick. Chapstick and a book.
No salt, no hot sauce. Like no. Beyonce.
No, although when I was in college, I would smuggle sriracha and Maggie into the dining hall mm-hmm. because they just didn't, you know, they were ignorant. They didn't have that stuff.
Yeah. So, Leho, thank you.
Thank you.